Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, the man of the subprime hour, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson.
Nothing is worse than doing nothing.
Question is, what is being done? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 3rd of December today. This one is a Monday, and it's great to have you with us. The conference in Washington today was officially called the National Housing Forum, but it might as well have been the What Have You Done For Us Lately, Hank gathering. We mentioned Friday Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's trying to engineer some kind of fix, or at least a Band-Aid, for the continuing subprime mortgage mess. The topic du jour is the millions of mortgages still out there waiting for rates to reset or for foreclosures to begin. The White House is negotiating with the mortgage industry to somehow freeze rates on some of those loans. Paulson said today he hopes to have a plan in place by the end of the week to do that, but that it's not going to be easy.
The company collecting your mortgage payment every month is most often doing that on behalf of those who own the mortgage. And they are limited in decisions that they can make on behalf of those ultimate owners who are spread all over the world.
There are, in this country, about 2 million mortgages at risk over the next couple of years. Paulson didn't say how many his plan might help, but he did try to share the political pain.
The administration and the private sector are taking action. Congress needs to act now.
Structural reforms is what the secretary is calling on Congress to do. Moving on now, in the land of credit availability, we've talked about SIVs before. Today, we're going to have to talk about them again. Structured investment vehicles. Moody's, the credit rating agency, is warning that it might soon downgrade $105 billion in debt related to some of those SIVs. It would be the biggest rating cut since the subprime crisis hit this past summer, and it would not at all be what the credit industry is looking for. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay has more.
Structured investment vehicles raise money from investors and put it into high-yielding bonds. A lot of those bonds are backed by subprime mortgages. Charles Jones is a finance professor at Columbia Business School. He says in return for their money, investors get short-term notes from the SIVs. Now Moody's says it may downgrade those notes. Jones says the bonds in many of the SIVs are worth half of what they were 6 months ago.
That the bond market is still very sick. You wouldn't know it from the stock market, which seems to be coming back nicely.
The downgrades of those notes could cause problems for money market and pension funds. Janet Tavakoli is the president of her own structured finance strategy firm. She says the money market funds own a lot of those notes. The funds could end up taking losses.
That's a very big issue for investors who expected this to be very safe and to give them their full money back if they redeemed their money. And that's what money market funds are grappling with.
The downgrade could also complicate a plan directed by the Treasury to bail out the SIVs. Columbia's Jones says these downgrades could spook investors. He's worried about a fire sale of mortgage-backed bonds.
This is, I think, an indicator that we've taken another step toward the edge of the cliff.
Jones says the SIV bailout is still in the cards, but Wall Street firms will now have to pony up a lot more money to make it work. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
When we woke up this morning, Dell was a computer company. By the time the markets went to bed tonight, Dell had become an advertising powerhouse. The company says it's going to create its own ad agency. It's going to hire 1,000 people and spend $4.5 billion over the next 3 years to do it. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has more.
Dell says it'll launch its own agency in conjunction with the international ad giant WPP.
They're leveraging their
size to get what they want.
That's advertising professor Ken Wilber of the University of Southern California. He says what Dell wants is to have all the traditional functions of an ad agency under one roof, from the creative side to the placement of those ads in different media. Before now, Dell was working with over 800 marketing firms to sell its computers.
More and more large advertisers are demanding that their agencies consolidate these different functions to make sure that the same message is going out to consumers through many different touch points.
Marketing guru Seth Godin says in the age of the internet, it takes more than clever slogans and jingles to sell a product. Marketers want to know where their messages are going and when.
Procter & Gamble runs an ad for Tide. They don't know if it works or not. But when Dell runs an ad with a phone number in it, they know within an hour whether it worked or not.
Godin says the faltering Dell has another challenge, overcoming a battery recall, management woes, and a raft of bad publicity from unhappy customers.
Dell doesn't need better advertising. They need better products. The only place to invent profit is with design and style, and they better start.
Godin says being a bit more Apple-esque might help Dell reclaim from HP its status as the number one seller of computers. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
AT&T is hanging up its payphone business. Hard to believe, perhaps, but the company better known these days for providing wireless service to Apple's iPhone still operates some 65,000 payphones. AT&T says it's selling out before they become unprofitable. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
AT&T is following an industry-wide trend. 10 years ago, there were more than 2 million payphones in the U.S. But by last year, the FCC says that number had dropped to just over a million. Telecom consultant Gary Arlen says the wireless age has made the old payphone nearly obsolete.
They're just not being used. They're a pain to maintain. And with something like 60 to 70% of people having mobile phones, they just don't need a payphone.
And 95% of U.S. households have mobile or landline service in their homes or apartments. But even the most dedicated cell phone user can end up with a dead battery. Then what? Hope you can find a working payphone. Verizon still operates them in the Northeast, but most payphones are owned by small, independent companies, some with questionable service records. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
November was mostly a downer for Detroit. Ford reported narrowly higher sales last month. GM and Chrysler lost more ground. We learned all that today. Same, I suppose, could be said for Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Wall Street was down today, as I mentioned. The main European exchanges lost ground, too. Same for the Shanghai Composite. But if you want to look a little farther afield for investment opportunities, the Ho Chi Minh Stock Index was up 1.5% today. Vietnam is one of the most promising of what have come to be called frontier markets. One way to think of them might be as emerging economies that haven't really emerged yet. John Authors is the investment editor at the Financial Times over in London. We've called him up for a little bit of insight on this. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Is there a textbook definition that we could sort of use as we think about these countries?
Different people have very different definitions of the frontier. But the countries that tend to be on the list most often are the countries of the Arabian Peninsula. And many of those got ahead of themselves and had an extremely sharp crash last year, which is actually good news because it means that they're now very much cheaper, having been more expensive before. And many of them have been traditionally pegged against the dollar, and it's difficult to see how long that will last. If they decide to let their currencies go free, then they could very quickly but get a lot bigger than they are now.
Let me run a couple of names by you and get your reaction. First of all, Vietnam, is that in play here?
Very, very much so. In many ways, Vietnam is now where Mexico was, say, 10 or 15 years ago, and where China was maybe 5 years ago. It's a great, well-organized play on spectacularly cheap labor. It can undercut even China, and they're very quickly following the model of development that you've already seen in the countries I've just mentioned, having got their foothold by having the cheap labor move forward to more advanced products.
Let me go to what might be the other end of that definition if you want to spread it really wide. A country that I've been reading a little bit about as I research our talk, Zimbabwe.
That's an intriguing one. Certainly plenty of people would not put that on the frontier yet. One of the things that has driven the emerging markets and which has helped countries like Brazil or Russia truly emerge, at least on some measures, is the huge boom in commodity prices. If you are a mineral-rich or in other ways commodity-rich country in that band in southern Africa, there are ways in which you could become a frontier market. Obviously, you need to make some extremely careful decisions about the political system. There could be some very interesting bargains to be found there. You obviously have to do an awful lot of due diligence first.
Is this specifically stock investment, equity investment that we're talking about here, or is it foreign direct investment, the buying of companies and capital assets?
The level that's attracting the most interest at the moment is what you call portfolio investing, buying in stocks, because obviously you've got this boom from hedge funds. That's why it's as high on the agenda as it is.
Mm. Are these frontier markets becoming more attractive because of what's going on in some of the more developed economies, like Wall Street and the American economy, with some uncertainties about the credit squeeze, and even some of the what you call now emerged markets of Brazil and India?
That's a big part of why the frontier markets are getting more popular. Another key thing we should mention is that money managers want markets that are not correlated to the places they're already in, so that they really get some diversification, some spreading of their risks by going there. And that's not really what you get in Brazil, for example, anymore. Generally speaking, Brazil is what you might call a geared play on the US. When the US is up 2%, Brazil is up 3%. When it's down 2%, Brazil is down 3%. That doesn't give you any great diversification benefit. Some of the frontier countries really have so much less exposure to the global economic factors that you've got a real chance of finding something that will continue to rise even if the West goes into a slowdown.
John Authors is the investment editor at the Financial Times. Mr. Authors, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
John Authors was just telling us about the potential and the perils of frontier markets. As he said, their popularity has come in part because of the global boom in oil and metals. Rising commodity prices are bringing in big money. Commentator Paul Collier says this is a moment poor countries can't afford to squander.
Many of the world's poorest nations now have a big opportunity. They're sitting on commodities which are hugely valuable on global markets. This is their best chance for transformation, but we've been here before. The last time this happened was the boom of the 1970s, but that opportunity was not utilized for sustained growth. Take Nigeria. The nation brought in around $100 billion from the oil spike, but instead of putting that money into developing the nation's economy, politicians used it to throw a party. International standards could address the key government decisions that determine whether commodity revenues are utilized for development. For example, how should the right to extract commodities be sold? To date, sales have often been private deals between ministers and companies. That way, companies bribe or outsmart governments at the expense of their citizens. If instead the rights were sold through auctions, companies would have to compete openly. The true value would be revealed through competition among the bidders. The distinctive feature of a commodity auction is that all the suitors are sophisticated corporations, so there are no bargains. Auctions of this sort have the potential for misconduct, so they would need to be internationally verified. Each key decision could be guided by standards. Citizens would then know what to demand of their governments. Those that refused to adopt them would be revealed as crooked. If international standards were voluntary, would they be effective? Well, we already have one and it's working. In 2002, Tony Blair launched an initiative for governments to tell their own citizens what revenues they receive. It was seized on by reformers in Nigeria, and many governments have now adopted it. Revenue transparency was the right place to start, but it will be the wrong place to stop. The populist pressures to use revenue booms for a party are strong, and guidelines can help to counter them. They help because reformers are only human and can easily fall out. A standard provides a common rallying point. Reformers in the bottom billion are struggling to prevent a repeat of history. We can help them.
Paul Collier's latest book is called The Bottom Billion. He's also the director of the Center for the Study of African Economies at Oxford University. Drop us a line when you get a minute. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, a sleazy sale drives one car dealer to a new calling.
When the business manager walked out of the office, he and the salesperson high-fived each other because the dealership had made $5,000 profit off of this woman, and I just couldn't stand it anymore.
But first, let's do the numbers. There was a convergence of unsettling economic news today, including signs of a manufacturing slowdown, and so the Dow Industrials sank 57 points, 0.4%. Wrapped up trading at 13,314. The NASDAQ lost 23 points, 0.9%, closed at 2637. The S&P 500 lopped off 8 points, 0.6%, ended the day at 1472. Financials took the biggest hit. E-Trade shares plunged more than 10%. Fannie Mae lost around 5.5%. Freddie Mac slipped about 4%. Even some decent profit reports weren't good enough to overcome investor jitters. The country's biggest insurance firm, MetLife, predicted earnings will rise thanks to what it called unusually strong investment results. But the outlook wasn't quite as good as analysts were expecting, and so MetLife shares lost 1.25%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Siemens. From grade school to grad school, Siemens supports America's next generation of innovators with Student Science Days, plus scholarships and awards for students, schools, and teachers. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, credit card holders and reps from credit card companies testify at a Senate subcommittee hearing focusing on unfair interest rate increases. President Bush holds a news conference in the AM. Funding for the war in Iraq is expected to be on the agenda. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce discusses protecting our competitive edge, supply chain bottlenecks, and the U.S. economy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Apart from the occasional mention of the European Union, we don't really have much reason to talk about Belgium on this program. Much of the EU's bureaucracy is based in Brussels, the capital city, but the country itself is in the middle of its biggest political crisis ever. It's been nearly 6 months since national elections, and still, there is no government. Just this weekend, leaders of the separate Dutch and French-speaking populations called off negotiations. The French-speaking Walloons want to keep the country together. More than half of the Dutch-speaking Flemish want independence, largely for economic reasons. John Larson reports from the Flemish city of Leuven on the divide that could split Belgium in two.
You see the difference as soon as you cross Belgium's invisible dividing line from Wallonia into Flanders. Flanders looks wealthier, lots of carefree people riding bikes, shopping and lunching in cafes. Leuven built its fortune on beer. The Stella Artois factory is here. But so are high-tech firms like LMS that produces software for Boeing, Airbus and Ferrari. Flanders is an economic success story. Wallonia to the south is not. The mayor of Leuven is Louis Toback.
The situation in Flanders is that of a very rich part of Europe, with only luxury problems, with close to full employment, while in Wallonia you still have unemployment of 25%. So in the face of two different evolutions, you have to adopt two different policies. And that is not possible within the actual framework of the state.
Many Flemings also say they're tired of subsidizing economic failure. In a cafe, political commentator Mia Dornart tells me Wallonia should be taken off the drip.
The money which has been transferred to Wallonia, it went to creating or keeping jobs in the public sector or in all sectors of industry, but it hasn't been used to turn the region around, to invest in new industries, in new technologies, and so the feeling is that the money disappears in a bottomless pit.
The annual fair at Liège, Wallonia's largest town. They used to call this place the Burning City. The sparks from the steel mills lit up the sky at night. But the heavy industry that was the economic engine of Flanders and Wallonia is long gone. People here are noticeably poorer. But a new generation of Walloon politicians believes that if Belgium is to survive long term, Wallonia has to revitalise its economy. This is Senator Alain Destex.
I still hope that a compromise could be found. What we should do from our side is modernize our economy, which leads to Wallonia and the south of the land to catch up with Flanders.
Destex believes Belgium is worth keeping intact. It's a name known abroad. It's not a bad calling card. And separation could destroy Brussels, capital of Belgium, Flanders and the European Union. Students, their faces painted with the black, gold and red of the Belgian flag, singing their support for Belgium in the centre of Brussels. Walk round this city these days and you'll see flags hung out the windows of people's houses by ordinary citizens like this man.
At a time we are talking about Europe made of so many countries, it's useless and completely stupid and irrelevant to divide a small country with 10 million inhabitants like Belgium. We are back to the tribes from the ancient times.
And what would happen to Brussels, do you think, if they split?
It will die out.
Next week marks half a year since Belgium was last ruled as a single country. Some are now wondering if it ever will be again. In Brussels, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Social entrepreneurs are those who try to use their businesses to fix part of what's wrong with the economic world. Steve Tripoli has been keeping an eye on them for us from behind the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, and he is back today with a story of 63-year-old Robert Chambers. Mr. Chambers could be enjoying a carefree retirement right about now, but he chose not to do that because there was something left over from his working days, and it was bugging the heck out of him.
Robert Chambers' post-retirement career was born at a New Hampshire car dealership a while back. He was working there one morning when the sales force was called together. A $1,000 bonus was offered to anyone who could sell an older car with 70,000 miles on it. Shortly after that, a young woman walked in, a single mother earning $11 an hour. The salesman steered her to the bonus car. She bid on a high price, but then was told there'd be a problem getting financing. Chambers picks up the story.
She had gone through a divorce and had ended up with some credit issues, so she was financed at a very high interest rate. And she was sold a very expensive warranty on the car. And when she drove off, this car was financed over a five-year period of time, which is typical. But I knew that that car would be dead in 3 years or would have significant mechanical problems. And when the business manager walked out of the office, he and the salesperson high-fived each other because the dealership had made $5,000 profit off of this woman. And I just couldn't stand it anymore.
Chambers says unsophisticated working people get shafted on used cars all the time. What irks them even more is that they can often get new cars for the same overall cost, but no one tells them that's possible. So Chambers chose not to retire after leaving car sales, even though he was well set from owning several businesses. Instead, he channeled his frustrations into cooking up a new business called Bonnie Clack. Clack stands for Car Loans and Counseling. It gives lower-income people two things they rarely get on big purchases, the bargaining clout of a group plus a heavy dose of guidance.
Do you know what was the interest rate on your car loan before when you purchased your Toyota?
At one of Bonnie Clack's seven New Hampshire offices, Counselor Verdina Mekic runs a mandatory financial literacy course for clients. On this day, she's educating a young couple about the hidden ways car costs add up.
If you have, let's say, 10-year-old car that constantly needs repairs, the average repair would be $140 a month. This $140 a month...
The couple shoot each other knowing glances. They've already been burned by repairs on their clunker. Robert Chambers learned long ago that lousy car deals can sabotage a struggling family's shot at getting ahead. Workers can't get to work when old cars fail, so they're losing pay at the same time they need repair money. That triggers other financial pressures.
It's a kind of a circular trap that they can't get out of, and they can't go to buy the new car because they don't have the credit, and also because they're never introduced to that new car because the dealership doesn't make enough profit.
But a good car can reverse that cycle. So Bonnie Clack brokers the purchase price, loan, and extended warranty on clients' cars. It also insists on high-mileage vehicles. Best of all, it struck a deal with a regional bank so clients with less than pristine credit can get low-cost financing. Bonnie Clack clients get prime interest rates, and Chambers brags that losses from these supposedly risky loans have been microscopic.
Our success rate is better than commercial lending. On a portfolio of $10 million with 985 clients, we've lost $46,000.
It turns out Robert Chambers isn't just some wacky oddity among could-be retirees. A San Francisco-based nonprofit called Civic Ventures recently made him a finalist for its Purpose Prize. It rewards social entrepreneurship by people over 60. Civic Ventures head Mark Friedman says many retiring baby boomers are itching to make a difference, just like Robert Chambers did, and now they have the means.
This generation is better educated, they have more financial resources, they have a longer life expectancy, and I think that they have higher expectations about what's possible in this stage of life, and many of those expectations are focused on the greater good.
Friedman expected a few dozen nominees for last year's first Purpose Prizes. More than 1,200 stories about social entrepreneurs over 60 rolled in. Back in New Hampshire, Robert Chambers is just warming up. He'll start expanding Bonnie Clack across New England in January. If that works, a large foundation has promised to help him go national. So at 63, Chambers says he's having too much fun to retire and making too much of a difference. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, police recruits in New York City will be getting a little bit something extra. The NYPD is giving newbies at its police academy iPods to help them with their coursework. The department says that now recruits will be able to go over their homework on the subways. The iPods will come preloaded with lectures on penal law, ethics, warrants, and community policing. No word yet on how much this will cost the department, but the city's current class is at 947 people. The department also says, by the way, to be careful flashing your iPod on the subway, lest it be stolen from you. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 57 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq skidded down 23 points, about 0.9%. The S&P 500 dipped 8 points. That is 0.6% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, in China, religion and commerce cross paths in some unexpected ways.
Chinese really love Jews. They think that Jews are the smartest people in the world and they're the best at business.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.